The Radio Misfits Podcast Network.
Welcome to Misfits Making It. We're oddballs and we're doing cool stuff. I'm your host, Lauren Lojudice. This is the podcast version of the comedy shows I host around New York City and the road, the Misfit Variety Show, and all the shows at the Capiche Club Misfit Comedy Space down in Little Italy. How's it going? What's up in your Misfit world? I've been good. You know, it's a weird time. I feel like, and a few other friends I've talked about this with have felt the same, where you're like so close and then things don't quite work out, but you're close. You're so close. You're like in the arena. Not only like in the arena, you're literally like, they're like, get ready to go up to bat. And then crickets. So it's been a weird time. I will say years ago, I would have blame this on myself. And I would have said like, oh, there's something wrong with me that other people are sensing and I will never be good enough and all these stories. But actually the guest today helped me see that thinking is ridiculous. All right. Before we get into this interview, a brief reminder, please rate and review the podcast because social proof is super important for Misfits because Misfits trust other Misfits to know what's good. You can also sign up at laurenlogie.com or you can sponsor a podcast. We make it accessible for individuals or small companies. We put out the podcast about once every three-ish weeks, but we'll put it out more often if we get a sponsor. So go to laurenlogie.com, click on listen and podcast and contact us there. All right. Today we are interviewing musician Alan Limbrick. I know Alan through Home Exchange, actually. We became friends many years ago from that system and came to know his story. He's lived an incredible life. He started out as a musician in England, actually. And then, Wales. He'll kill me. Wales. He's from Wales. But he did eventually get to London. But he started out as a musician in Britain, should I just say, to just not cause any more trouble. And then he has performed for some of the biggest acts around, has done music all over the world, and now lives half of the year in France, the south of France, and half of the year in Australia. I mean, he is a misfit who has made it. I mean, he has made it, and he's going to tell you a little bit more about that. One of the things that I love about Alan is that he's so real and like pulls no punches about anything to do with show business. He's just so matter of fact about everything. And one thing he really helped me see is that so much of this is luck and timing. And it's not like personal failing of anything. And this is not a talent contest, folks. Like a lot of my friends are like blaming themselves because they think, well, talent rises to the top. Why aren't I getting it? It's like, no, honey, this ain't what it is. So like right now I'm in this weird period where like I've almost got 85 million things, but not quite. And it's like years past, I might've been like, there's something, they're sensing something. There's an error about me. And now I'm like, no, it's just the way it is. And like, it's like that I get, don't get something doesn't like make something that means that I deserve to get the next thing. Cause it's all luck. So you just kind of got to let go and have fun. So I think this interview is going to help you do that too. So let's get to it with your friend and mine, Alan Limbrick.
All right. Welcome to Misfits Making It, Alan Limbrick.
Good day. Bonjour. Hello.
And you're calling in from the south of France,
right?
Correct?
Côte d'Azur. Yep. It's stinking hot here, full of tourists.
Right.
They are called, the people who come for their vacations in August are called the Outiens, as opposed to the people who come in July who are called the Juilletistes. Juilletistes. And right. It's a class thing, I think, for French. I think one of them who take their 2 weeks in July are less or more well-to-do than those in August. I can't remember the order. I think maybe the August ones are a little bit posher. Anyway, they're congesting the hell out of the roads, and I'm glad to be home.
Wow. So you're from Wales. You live in the south of France. You're an English or a British gentleman in the south of France, living half the year there, half the year in Australia. And I want to tell people, like, where kind of you started from Wales and where a scene that kind of encapsulates where you are now. I remember it was a gig of yours in Byron and you were on stage with your band, the Pheromones, and everyone would like, the whole room was like being rocked. Like everyone was like screaming. There was like someone actually hanging from the rafters. There's like people.
That's me. That's all about me.
And then these Italian guys were, I remember this group of Italian guys were like jumping together arm in arm, like screaming like teenage girls at you. They're like, they're so good. Cause you guys like rock it. Like your guitar playing, your instrument. It's just so, and so insanely good. Oh. So this is where you ended up.
Nice. That was years ago. You should see them now. If you think they went crazy then. Oh my God. I tried to film a little bit of the last encore, the last gig in April, and it would have been so unreal to have captured it, but I moved the camera too quickly and it just came out awfully. I'm going to get one of the crew to do it next time because it's such a great vibe at the end of the night, you know, and it was that same venue where you saw us. And
yeah.
It would be a really cool, what you see from stage would be really nice to have a little, you know, a little video of.
Yeah. So you got there, but you started all the way in Wales. You were.
Yeah, in Cardiff. In Wales, that's where I grew up.
Humble town in Wales, yeah. Right?
Well, it's a capital city, you know. It's a pretty cool town, especially nowadays. But then it was a pretty cool place. It had a big Jamaican population, second generation Jamaicans, West Indians, whose parents and grandparents were, I guess, came over for you know, cheap labor force in the 40s and 50s. And so we had there was a great black music scene there, which I was privy to and kind of. So I did my musical apprentice in the Welsh Valleys, you know, with the home of the Welsh choir and the singing, and the artist Tom Jones made that area famous. But there was just loads and loads of gigs. So I could play in all those working men's clubs in the Welsh Valleys. And as I progressed, I got more and more into black music. There was a fantastic scene in the docks area of Cardiff, live music scene. So I was able to play there and got to play in, you know, with Rastafarians, and played a lot of reggae, played a lot of funk, a lot of soul, with the real deal, with the brothers. You know,
yeah.
I was often the only white guy in the band, and that was fantastic apprenticeship for me.
So you were
so
how
that's
old?
Where I started.
Yeah, how old were you when you were?
I started when I was 15. My dad used to drive me to gigs because I was the young kid in the band. So my dad, as long as I got good grades in school, my dad would play ball and he'd take me to the gigs and roadie for me. That's how it worked. And, you know,
wow. And so like you were good enough to play in gigs when you were 15?
Yeah. Yeah. I was pretty good when I was 15. I was all right. I was competent.
When did
I could read music.
Yeah.
I could read music because I'd learned to play classical guitar from age 12. So yeah, 15, I was in bands doing gigs, and there were lots of gigs around, lots and lots. There were rock gigs, there were, you know, mainly rock gigs I was doing. And then by the time I got to my sort of later teens, I kind of progressed and went pro in 1976, at the age of 18. And there was a really cool live music scene in Germany. A lot of it was on American air bases, and a lot of it was the clubs that the likes of the Beatles played in the 60s. That circuit was still there for the rest of the 1970s. So, and you had to play long hours. So that was, again, that was just a great, you know, part of the apprenticeship.
Wow. So you were, and then you were in Germany after that.
Played in Germany, went pro there, lived in Munich for 6 months twice in 76 and 77, and did all the big clubs, you know, did residencies in other clubs in most of the major German cities. And it was just a great music scene, and they love British bands. And then back to Cardiff. Well, then I moved to London. Then I left Cardiff and moved to London after that, and started getting on my feet there. And then decided that the best thing for me would be to try and lift my game as quickly as possible and go to this killer school, music school, that offered great courses in electric guitar in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, Los Angeles, in California. And it was called Musicians Institute. And the famous guitar school there was called GIT, Guitar Institute of Technology. And I was one of the first British guys to go there. And I went there and lived in the States for a few years. And then that really paid off. And then came back and settled in London. And I'd kind of, you know, mission accomplished. I lifted my game. I'd got to a different level. And then that kind of really kickstarted my professional playing career, I guess.
What is so different about this is that you were like, to get ahead, I got better at my craft, which is like not how people think of it today. Like to get better, I need to start a TikTok feed to get ahead. So that's why it's just so different to hear that. Cause I don't hear that often anymore.
Well, that's how it was done in those days. I mean, yeah. I don't even know what a TikTok feed is.
Yes, you do not do any of that shit. Yeah.
No, I only found out, in fact, all of our band found out about TikTok last December, as a matter of fact, because there was a new venue we were playing in Australia, and it was a much younger crowd than usual. And we were thinking, you know, how are we going to go down? And we killed it. And someone said afterwards, they loved you because you played loads of the TikTok playlist. And that's how I found out about TikTok. So apparently 70s classic rock stuff is big on TikTok.
Right. And you're playing instruments like in front of them, which they're not used to. They're used to, well, a lot of people are doing like instrumental type stuff. I remember I tried to play you Lady Gaga once, and I think it was like a verse in and you were like, get this off. I cannot listen to this.
She's good though. Look, she's really talented. I have a lot of time for her. Right. You know, she's the real deal, and she uses real musicians. Perhaps not the stuff you played me.
Right. Actually, you know, maybe it wasn't Lady Gaga. Maybe it was someone of lesser. Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Probably it might have been someone that used, you know, more computer based loops and things. And that it's not my thing. I don't enjoy listening to them.
Right. It was someone really awful. I think it was. That's why I play. I wanted to just see what you thought of someone really awful. Yeah, Lady Gaga is amazing. We love you, Lady Gaga. and she loved Tony Bennett, which makes me love her. So that's.
She's pretty cool.
So when you say residency in Germany, what did that mean? What does that mean exactly? Did you have a band that was like booked there?
Yeah. So our band, we had an agent. So before I went to music school, I went to hotel hospitality school and did a diploma in hotel management. And at that time, on that course at that college, I became the social secretary and booked the bands. The stories there. And I had an in with the local agents. This is in Cardiff. And one of the agents booked bands in Germany. He ended up, probably still is, a fairly big-time agent in London. But at the time, he was in Cardiff. Jake Jacobs was his name, a real character. And I helped him out and booked this German band who broke the axle on their truck. And they needed a gig for £25. This is the truth. To fix the axle on their van so they could get back to Germany. I said, well, I can put them on, but I had a folk act on that night. This was a seriously heavy metal band. Turned out it was the Scorpions.
Wow.
They are now? They're enormous. Anyway, so that was that. So I put them as the opening act for a folk artist called Jack the Parrot. Pretty wild. Anyway, the agent then owed me a favor, and he sent my band over. When I finished this catering college, he sent my band over to Germany for 2 weeks. They liked us at the club, and we ended up doing 6 months. And then we went back, and then we played around other clubs in Germany, in Frankfurt and Berlin and Hamburg. There was a real circuit and a few American air bases. And then we went back to England, and then the agent took us back to Germany. We did another 6 months. There was a great club there in Munich called the PN Club, owned by a guy called Peter Naumann, hence PN. And just down the road from this rock club where you started like at 10 at night and you played 10 until 2 a.m., something like that, real late, hard work. And you did four sets. And when you finished, there was an all-night jazz club about 100 yards down the road. And it was called the Domicile Club. Real, very, very classy underground jazz club. Got exposed to all sorts of fantastic music there. It was when Stevie Wonder's double album, Songs in the Key of Life, had come out. And there was a killer band there, from mostly the Bohemian guys, black guys. There was like about 10 of them. And they were playing this stuff that we'd never heard. And they were killing it. And that was a big turning point as well, from being just into rock. Suddenly it was like, I want to play this
music. So did your band play original music, or were you guys playing covers?
Some, but mostly covers.
Got it.
Yeah, mostly like 70s covers. Ironically, probably quite a lot of that set we probably do now in the Pheromones. If you go going back to where you started.
So, I don't know anything about the music industry, but I have heard that like, you often bands will get started playing covers, and then they, after a certain point, then they play original music. Is that true?
In a lot of cases, yeah. I think you'd find a lot of successful artists have come up that way. Certainly a lot of musicians who end up making a living playing come up through that way. I mean, in our band, the Pheromones, you know, Rick, the other guitarist, I think he's the only one that hasn't done that. He left college and joined a big famous band and just was an instant rock star. But the rest of us did the same as me. You know, we were all playing a lot of the music we play now in the Pheromones. We were playing that, you know, because we're a classic retro rock band. We were playing that stuff when it was first released in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
In the same way as I was on these clubs and doing these residencies, you know, in Europe and whatever.
So, yeah.
But a lot of bands do that. Yeah. It's like an apprenticeship.
Interesting. Yeah.
you know, it's the same with all artists. You know, you have to go and
Definitely.
And that's how you learn. You know, you got to put yourself out there and do it. Just, you can stay in your bedroom practicing, you know, if you're a dancer or a comedian or whatever, doing it in front of your mirror, recording yourself. If you're a musician, just practicing. But at the end of the day, you've got to go. There's a time when you've just got to go out and do it.
Yeah.
In front of people live.
Yeah. And you started doing that at 15. So then how old were you? And then you moved back to London. You went from LA back to London.
I moved to London when I was 19.
Yeah.
After the stint in Germany, stayed there on and off, trying my best to make a living there. And then when I was 22, I went to the States, realized I needed to get better fast. And that's when I heard about this great school in Los Angeles, and I went there and I stayed out there, and then went to Manhattan for about 11 months. And I was all set up there on the Upper East Side with a friend of mine who graduated with me from the Dominican Republic. And he'd taken a sabbatical to do this music school in California. And he was actually an accountant with CBS record company.
Oh, wow.
So he got his old job back. So he had this nice apartment. He was Hispanic, but he was probably a little bit Hispanic for me. It was kind of up there, close to Spanish Harlem. Anyway, I was all settled there, living there, playing, you know, starting to teach guitar and making a bit of money and being able to pay the rent. And then I came back to see my family. I hadn't been back for about 3 years. And to cut a long story short, they wouldn't renew my visa. I checked with the embassy and they said they would. And my dad checked and they said, no, we've extended it, you know, quite a few times when you're over there as a student. We're not going to extend it anymore because we think you're going to go back and work, which is exactly what I was going to do.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't let me back in. And I had to send my best buddy to go and get all my belongings. And that was the end of my stint in New York.
Oh, wow. So what do you think you would have done if you would have stayed in New York?
I'd have probably married a girlfriend of mine. We were just friends, pals, but she would have done a convenience marriage, you know, so I could get the green card. I would have probably done that. And then I would have probably ended up some broke would-be jazz musician. I don't know. Who knows? But it turned out pretty good because when I came back, you know, I was, you know, I was a bigger fish in a smaller pond. I mean, London's still a big pond, but compared to the States, it's easier to kind of access, get auditions at that time anyway. And I had friends who were, a couple of friends in particular, who were really doing well in the studio scene, and I had an in. So, and my old band was really delighted I came back, and we promptly got ourselves a record deal, and we had a good old shot at making it as a pop band.
Well, what is going back?
So it all kind of.
Well, what does an audition mean for musicians?
Well, in those days, there was music papers every week. There was about four or five of them every week came out in England, and the best one of all was called the Melody Maker. And at the back of the Melody Maker, in England, there were auditions, a couple of pages of jobs, you know, vacant positions in bands, wanted guitarists. A lot of them were bands going nowhere. But I mean, some were big bands. I mean, Genesis advertised for a singer when Peter Gabriel left Genesis, for instance, in the Melody Maker. A lot of big bands would put little classified ads in those days. So there was all sorts of, there was lots and lots and lots of work and gigs available still, even in the early 80s. It was just starting to change where technology was coming in, and like a lot of trades, like the printing industry, for instance, you know, the whole technology was taking the skill away from the skilled, out of the hands of the skilled, and making it available to the unskilled. So suddenly there was technology. If you were a drummer, you didn't have to be good anymore because they'd invented digital drum machines and loops and all that stuff. It was just starting.
Gotcha. So then there was more, I guess there was more need, because you would just use a drum machine instead of a drummer. Is that what people are doing? Or like?
To a certain extent, you still needed drummers to program them. And, you know, but it was a pretty scary time for a lot of musicians. You know, it's like, well, what's, you know, we're seeing what we suspected and turned out to be the thin end of the wedge. You know, there was this stuff coming out, all this digital equipment coming out, and it was going to make a lot of musicians redundant, that's for sure. You know, times were changing, and they did.
Yeah, it's kind of like what's happening now with AI and actors. Yeah, people are really afraid.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So now time has passed. Yeah. Do you feel like it's still like it? Like there are less gigs. What did you predict, and how did it fall out all these years later?
Yeah, when you're in your 20s, you're not really good at predicting. Most of us aren't anyway. So I didn't really think about it. But it is a very different world, and there aren't many gigs left. When I was out there gigging in London in 78 to 80, And then the early 80s, there were loads of fantastic rock clubs, loads and loads, as I know there were in New York City, you know, and Los Angeles. Yeah. There were just loads of great gigs. Those are all gone. They've all completely gone. There's hardly anything left. There are more gigs where I live in Australia, and we laugh about it. We can't believe it. You know, Byron Bay and that whole, within an hour of our hometown there are heaps of live music gigs, 7 nights a week. It's unreal.
Yeah.
That's why we're the six of us are still doing it.
Yeah, because the way you talked about, like, yeah, like, oh, how you were able to support yourself and getting gigs and being able to go to Germany. And then that's just like a fantasy world now. Like, musician friends are struggling way more. I know one friend, she had to like figure out how to just get rid of her band because she's a singer, songwriter, and like she couldn't afford
musicians
to bring anyone on the road. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That says it all. You know, you see lots and lots of soloists and duos, and they've got various forms of technology to help them out, and they've got to find loops and backing tracks and all sorts of stuff, and it sounds great, and they don't need a band, and audiences have got used to that.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, she came up in a time where she could have a band, and she doesn't like it, but it's like, what else, other choice does she have? You know, it's
rough. No choice. It's
so, what was the name of your band?
Lots of different names we had. In fact, there was a group of guys. We were the same group of guys, and we went under different names, different auspices, when we to play different styles of music. At one stage, I think we had four bands with the same guys, and we played every single week, completely different styles of music. I think we were called TVI for a jazz residency every Sunday, and we used to have people queuing up around the block to see us. And then in the Saturday and Sunday evenings, I think we called ourselves Northern Lights, and we went out and did the show band thing for money, covers, you know, to like social clubs. And then I think Monday we'd take off, hit the road early from Cardiff up to London. It was like a 3-hour trip. And then we'd be trying to do showcase gigs, not paid, just to try and get at clubs where record companies would come and see us in the weekday days. And then we'd have a different name for that. And then I think we came back and we had a funk residency in this black club in the docks area of Cardiff every Friday night. And we were called the Cavaliers in that. So it was a healthy time.
Yeah, that's super fun. You could just experiment and see.
Really busy.
So if you're, most people are doing, you're doing mostly covers, record companies come to see you, then like, what are they?
Oh no, then we would be doing completely original music. Yeah. We had this band. That band was called The Shine, and it did get signed. It had a pretty hefty recording deal with Chrysalis Records. In 84 we were signed, but unfortunately it was not successful. We released two singles. We had a lot of great material. Didn't do it. Didn't take off. I think the best we got was like top 70 in Germany. And we had a good innings. We had a good shot at it. You know, they put money into us. They toured us. We had a good crack. Who knows?
Yeah, it's who knows?
Luck.
Right. And this brings me to, so I have a lot of friends who will say they really believe in their heart of hearts that talent rises to the top. And that's how it works. And then when they don't, they are very talented, but they're not, whatever, quote unquote, getting commercial success, they blame themselves. And so I guess, can you speak to this idea that like, it's the way it works is talent rises to the top and that's how it goes?
Unfortunately, I hate to sound cynical, but in my experience, that doesn't work out always. I think the 4-letter word plays a big part in the whole thing, and that's luck. Looking, you know, like a movie star sure helps. It's show business. So if you've got a fantastic, you know, image and personality and a huge amount of talent, you know, if you look at some of these fantastic stars out there today that have gone the distance, a lot of them look fantastic. They've got incredible personalities and charisma, and they're super talented. They've got everything. They tick every single box. So I think, you know, in some cases, you know, like someone like Prince, how could he have never not made it? I mean, he had just everything. As an example. But, you know, there are other people that write. The singer in the band that I was in, and we're still friends today, he's gone off and toured and been in lots of other, you know, big bands. He's a guy called Neil Lockwood. And he was one of the most talented songwriters I've ever known. His songs, I still think a lot of his songs in those days when we had our band The Shine should have been international hits. Mm-hmm. Don't know. Maybe he had the wrong image, the wrong look. I don't know. But I do think a lot of it is luck. Right place, right time, who you know, all that cliched stuff. Unfortunately, you know, it's true. And I think it must be even even more prevalent in the acting world. I mean, how many talented actors are out there that don't make it? And how many untalented people that look great do make it? And then, sure, they take enough acting lessons and eventually they get better and better and better. But when they first get their break, I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons, you know, what they look like, who they know, blah, 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 that, you know, that given those initial breaks, other than just oozing with talent.
Right. I had a lunch with a manager who represents someone famous, and he was like laughing, like, she doesn't know how to act at all. She has a really amazing acting coach, and that's how she's able to do any of it. So, you know, just, you know, sure. But we don't know that on screen. Sure. She looks great. So.
Sure. And you can't knock people. I mean, I'm sure these people work really hard.
Yeah.
And you can't,
yeah.
You know, so you've got to admire that. If you've got the determination and you work really hard, I don't think it's just massive, massive God-given from the day you were born talent. I think a lot of it is hard work, perseverance, but above all, luck.
Yeah.
That's my thought.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's really helpful to people. And that, so you're okay. So you're back in London, you're in bands, you're playing in bands, you're releasing stuff. And then when did the London Guitar Institute come into play that you started?
Yeah. Yeah. That was the big change for me. That happened in about September, all of a sudden, just out of the blue. In September 1986, a guy had been in music college in the States. He and I had done some clinics, you know, together at the trade shows, at the British music fairs for different, you know, guitar and amplifier companies. And he knew this French guy who just come over from France and established a drum school. And he brought over a pretty unusual technique for drums that no one was really teaching in England. And a famous drummer from the band Yes, called Bill Bruford, took lessons with him and endorsed his school and allowed him to say lots of nice things about the school. It was called Drum Tech, and it started expanding. And he knew about the school that I'd been to in the States, and he asked this other guy, he said, hey, do you want to come in and open a bass guitar school? And do you know anyone who might want to do guitar? And we'll do three things, and we'll expand in the premises. I've got premises in West London, and we can expand the thing. And that's how it started. I was kind of reluctant to do it. They asked me if I wanted to do it. The other guy knew I taught. You know, I was a pretty good teacher, and I had quite a lot of private students at that time. I was starting to, you know, make my living that and doing studio dates and gigs. And I was kind of reluctant to do it because my band had just been dropped from the record label, but we were confident we were going to get re-signed. This is this band I was telling you about, The Shine. And at the same time, I'd done a session with Joan Armour Trading. I don't know if you remember Joan Armour Trading. She was a great singer songwriter. Had still is successful. Anyway, I'd done some recording with her, and there was an offer to join her touring band, and it was a world tour. And lots of my other friends said, "You should do it. It's going to give you a lot of credibility." Blah blah blah. And I said, "Well, I've had this kind of, you know, I think our band's going to get signed again, and I, you know, that's where my heart is. And also, I've just had this offer to open this guitar school." And they said, "What do you want to do that for? You know, you're going to have to pay rent every week. You're going to be tied down." So I was really reluctant to do it. Anyway, short story is I did it, and it took off immediately. It took off the very first semester we opened, and the rest is history. It just grew and grew and grew, and I built it up from nothing to when I sold the whole company in 2003 with all the schools under the same building that specialized in teaching guitar, bass, vocals, keyboards, drums. I didn't own the drum school, but we worked alongside each other in the same building. But the whole thing was responsible for over 750 students a week. So it was
wow, great. Wow, wow.
And that changed everything.
Yeah, and then you were no longer touring with people at that point?
Well, I'd kind of, you know, I put so much into the school those first few years, especially like any new business. You know, it was just growing at a crazy rate. It was very, very successful. There was nothing else like it. There was a need for it in England. And then what happened? Yeah, I was gigging, but I was kind of losing my love for music because I felt like a bit of a sponge. I was teaching 7 days a week and running the business and trying to grow the whole thing. So my actual love for playing the guitar was really losing the love and the passion for the whole thing. And then I came back from a vacation in Thailand, I think. And as I got through the front door, the phone rang. It was a buddy of mine who I'd been doing some clinics for guitar synthesizers. That's right, there was a killer guitar synthesizer called Synthax at the time. This guy, Jay Stapley, and I had been demonstrating these guitar synthesizers, very expensive, sophisticated instruments. So Jay knew me, and he knew I could play lots of different styles, because to demonstrate, you know, we went through a lot of different styles of music. And he said, hey, Mike Oldfield's releasing his comeback album from Tubular Bells, called Tubular Bells 2. He's left Virgin. He signed up with Warner Brothers. It's a big deal. And he wants someone who can play a lot of instruments and read music and follow a conductor. You got the gig. You don't have to audition. Do you want to do it? So I did it. I joined Mike's band, the touring band, and we did Tubular Bells 2. It was a pretty big album. And we did that for best part of 3 years. And that got me back playing again. So yeah, I did.
Yeah, you can see it on YouTube. We watched it on YouTube, the whole big
to-do. Went back to New York after I'd been kicked out and they wouldn't renew my visa. The next time I went back there was 1992, and with Mike and we headlined Carnegie Hall. It was a real okay up yours to the US Immigration Department.
Oh, that's funny. You know who had an up yours was Josephine Baker had her up yours at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
She came back after not being received well in the United States and finally had her big to do in Carnegie Hall. It must be it's the place.
Big star. Hasn't she recently died? They put her in the Pantheon, I think, and gave her.
They recently put her. She had died a long time, but they put her in the Pantheon recently.
They've just done it to a really famous French Resistance guy as well. Macron seemed to do it there.
Cool. Oh wow!
Yeah, she was a legend in France.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and you know, Jane Birkin just died. Do you know this week? She was the most French English woman ever. Do you know who she was?
Jane Birkin. I don't know who she was.
She was a real kind of Barbie doll young actress in the 60s and 70s, and then she moved to France, and the French loved her, and she married a real French legendary singer called Serge Gainsbourg. Have you heard of him? A real deep, deep throaty voice.
No.
Okay. Anyway, that's another story. That's all news this week.
So I'm more upset, Sinead and Pee-wee Herman. I'm still grieving.
Oh, yeah, of course. Sinead died this week. Last week? Yeah. Jane was upset.
Yeah, it's really sad. So, okay. So when you're losing your love for guitar, then touring for Michael Oldfield and playing you played like six guitars in that thing. It was insane. Every time you went, it was like another type of guitar.
Yeah, loads.
Then you sell your company.
Yep.
And then were you like, I'm going to start, what were you thinking you were going to do?
I thought I was going to just live in Australia and go surfing. And that's what I did do.
Okay.
Water sports. That was my new drug. It still is. But two of my buddies, colleagues, you know, my friend Rick Fenn, fabulous guitarist in the group 10cc, he came out for a vacation. And we've been doing this band, The Pheromones, with a pool of great musicians in London for quite a few years. Rick used the horn section from Cliff Richards, legendary English kind of the English art. I don't know if you know who Cliff Richards is, but he was the English answer to Elvis. He's still alive, he's still touring. I think he's 80 now. His keyboard player or musical director, and his wife at the time had been Cliff Richards' wardrobe lady. She was Australian and loved Byron Bay. He came out, so we had a keyboard player. My friend Rick said, "We love this place. My wife and I want to move here. Why don't we form a band?" So there were three of us living in Byron Bay. One of the main venues in the town wanted us to play, and they said, "We said we need a bass player and a drummer and a singer." Our singer from England came over originally. That's right. He was on tour, and he came over, and we put this band together with an Australian rhythm section. It was a big success. Went down a bomb, and the venue wanted us to play. We said, "Well, we'd have to find a singer as well." And that's how it all started. You know, the main venue in Byron Bay is called the Beach Hotel. You know that place? You went there? I'm sure you did.
Yeah, I remember that.
It's a great venue. It's arguably our favorite gig in the whole world, and we've played a lot of the world's finest gigs between the six of us. But that place is a sensational place to play, and we still play there. Four or five shows a year there. And they were responsible, really, the management there, for putting our band together. That really gave us, gave me a new, a rebirth in for playing guitar. And here we are 20 years later, still doing it and loving it more than ever. In fact, I'm practicing more than I have been for years at the moment. Don't know why. I'm just highly motivated.
Listen to it. And but you guys also started in England, right, as well?
Yeah. The other guitarist, Rick called it the Pheromones, and he had this pool of guys because he'd recorded the solo two or three solo albums with Nick Mason, who's the drummer with Pink Floyd, and Nick had this charity for children with leukemia. I don't know if it's still going, but he did this big event every year at one of London's top hotels, the Intercontinental, and he wanted Rick to put a band together. So Rick put this band together, called it the Pheromones, and they were the house band, and various artists would come up and sing with us, you know. So I did that with him for quite a few years, and then lots of other offers, showbiz kind of parties came in on the back of it, and that's how it really started in London. And then when we found ourselves living in Byron Bay, we said, well, let's do the Pheromones here. We just got to change a few of the musicians and get a few Aussie guys in. We ended up with a great Californian singer who you saw us with, who's been with us for 20 years, mm-hmm. called Germano. There's one American, I'm Welsh, Rick's English, the keyboard player is Scottish. So we're pretty international. And the bass player...
British, international, British.
We're very international. Scots, Irish, British. Welsh. No, not Irish, sorry. Scots, English, Welsh. And Californian and Australian. It's pretty international.
Okay, well, California, so you could do like Scotch, Welsh, British.
Scotch, Welsh, English. So the three Brits.
Brits.
All ardently nationalistic about our own countries. You know, whenever someone says, oh, you're English to me, I say, no, I'm Welsh. Let's make this clear. And so would the other Alan, who's Scottish. You know, you'd say, actually, I'm not English, I'm Scottish.
All right, and it's hard for us to understand because that's like going to New Jersey. It's so close, or Pennsylvania.
It is, yeah, but yeah.
That's the history.
Yeah, but, well, yeah, there's a big history.
Yeah, it's a big
Scots
deal.
Scots and the English, it's been a big deal. Have you seen the movie Braveheart?
Yes, it's a big
you
deal.
You haven't seen that? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's a big...
The Brits weren't very nice to the Scottish. Yeah. They weren't particularly nice to the Welsh either. And they were horrible to the Irish.
Yeah, and a few other countries as well. They
Yeah, and they weren't the last to be horrible of who we consider to be civilized countries now to be horrible to other countries. I'm just reading a great book called The Miracle of China. Oh my God, did the two Roosevelt presidents do some awful things that were responsible for an awful lot of bad things that happened in China. There you go.
Well, speaking of the English, according to the website, you guys played for the royal family. Were you part of those gigs?
I missed that gig. No, I was in Australia, and they did it. I think they did it in the summertime. I think they did it in August. So no, they did that one without me. But apparently Harry and Will were completely drunk and were giving it large on the dance floor. it was Charles's wife, Camilla's son's wedding they did.
Camilla's
son. The Pheromones played Tom Parker Bowles. The Pheromones did that wedding.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was not in the lineup.
Wow.
It was the English Pheromones.
Camilla. Okay, that's...
What's that?
Oh, that's a booing sound. Okay.
Camilla. Do you boo Camilla in America?
I do because the people who know about Diana, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, poor old Diana. She didn't get treated very nicely, did she?
Oh, she did not. No.
There we are.
Cuzzy, I call her. Well, I mean, I might be distantly related to her, who knows. But yeah.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yeah, you told me that.
I call her Cuzzy. Yeah.
You are full of surprises, Laurie.
You never know. Cool. So what do you think was like a moment? So now you live half the year in the south of France, half the year in Australia. You're part of this very successful touring rock band. And what do you think? I mean, when you were a kid, what do you think was the moment you were like, I can never live in a conventional life? Because you've certainly, a musician is unconventional, but like you've set your life up to be, I mean, unconventional in the unconventional. Like what was the moment where you knew like you were going to go on this path?
Well, I think it was when I first came to this area where we live now, the nearest little town to us, our little town, as you know, is called Santa Gulf, and the next one is called San Rafael. And I came there with my school buddies. In fact, one of whom is coming over to stay with me next week, the week after next. We're still pals after all these years. We came over here camping after school for 12 weeks in 1974. And I fell in love with this area then. And I loved the climate. I'd never been to somewhere warm before in my life. I realized then that living for the rest of my life in cold, wet, dreary Britain was not for me. I just hated the climate. So it was really, really wanting to live, having a dream of wanting to live somewhere warm all the time. That's what did it. So it was something I'd always had this as a dream. I didn't really, have any aspirations of living in some huge palace and having airplanes and having all these, trappings. I just wanted to be able to have somewhere to live where I was warm all year round. And that's really where it came from. So I don't know if it's that unconventional, but it was something that I wanted to do for a long, long time. And my partner, Jane, was like-minded, thank goodness. And so we set off looking for somewhere like that, gosh, in the early 90s. We tried a few different places out around the world, and then we found Australia. We just thought, well, at that time, it was very, very cheap to buy a home in Australia. And the exchange rate was crazy. They had our sense of humor. There was no issue with the language. And it was pretty easy for us to get, citizenship as well. So it was an easy path to take, to be perfectly honest. And I knew I didn't really want to run a music school or run a business for the rest of my life. That was great. It was successful. I loved it. I loved the creative side of it. But I knew there'd come a time when I couldn't really take the creative side level any further. I'd reach my limit, and I did. And that's when I sold it.
But it's so cool, as you were saying, when you were down in your younger years, when you were down in the south of France, you were like camping on the beach.
Camping on the beach, actually in a forest, which is now the marina there. And in fact, I was trying to find some photos of it last night. I'd love to see it. Someone sent me a video of Byron Bay in the 60s, and it was hilarious, actually. These young surfy chicks, just talking about why they loved being Byron Bay. This is in the 1960s.
Oh, my God.
But you should have seen it. There was no infrastructure there. It was this big pier where they hauled in whales. It was a whaling port. Horrific. And it was just blood and guts in the ocean, and that's what attracted all the sharks. And the sharks have passed on the memory of that to their offspring, and generations later, that's why we still get sharks there. They remember that there was food, and the smell of blood from those days.
Oh, wow.
So I was looking for some old photos of San Rafael, and I haven't found any yet, but in those days we were camping in the forest, which is all, apartment blocks now. But
yeah.
We just loved it. I just loved the place.
Yeah.
Absolutely a love affair from the get-go.
And then you ended up back there. That's super cool. Not everyone does that, so that's super cool.
How did you guys like it? You've just been over again for the second time at the South.
Yeah.
Do you love it? Is it one of your favorite places? Or can you take it or leave it?
I love France in general.
You do?
I do love France. Cool. And the more that I'm there, the more I love it.
And did you love down the South? Was it too hot for you?
The people are different. They're sweeter in a way. Because like in Paris, have more of an edge.
Yeah. A bit more like New York, isn't it, Paris?
Yeah. I do love it. Well, you've been around a lot of famous people. So you're very humble, but you've worked with and you've played with and you're colleagues with a lot of famous people. Do you feel like seeing their journey? Do you feel like fame is all it's cracked up to be?
No, I don't think I'd like to be fame. I mean, what does fame means that lots of people know you, doesn't it? Really, that's my definition of fame.
Yeah.
Well, I like being low profile me. The older I get, the less I want lots of people to know me. So it's not for me. I don't envy them. I played in a band once with a really well-known English comedian called Lenny Henry. You heard of him? Black guy? Yeah.
Oh, of course. Yes, I do. I just read his book. Yeah.
He used to come to my school for guitar lessons, funny enough. That's how we became friends. And he invited me in his band. And I played in his band for a couple of years. It was a really cool band called Lenny Henry and the Poor White Trash. Killer musicians in the band. And we did all sorts of really cool, interesting gigs. And I remember, and Hugh Laurie was the piano player, who now is a big movie star. Hugh is now a famous movie star in that show House.
Yeah.
He was just a humble piano. Well, he wasn't. He was a very talented scriptwriter with Stephen Fry. Fry and Laurie were a writing team. But Hugh just played piano in the band. He was a very unassuming, nice guy, funny as hell. And I remember rehearsing once, and we had a break, and we went to this cafe. It was a Sunday. And I remember all these people were coming in, saw Lenny Henry through the cafe window, and they were coming in, wanting his autograph, wanting to talk to him. And he was so charming about the whole thing. He couldn't do enough for people. And I thought, wow, I would hate that. I would absolutely hate to be in that position. I could never do that. And I thought, well, so the answer to your question is, I think some people it works for. Some people it suits. Him, it certainly suited. He was a natural editor, and he genuinely seemed to enjoy engaging with whoever wanted to talk to him. But I would have thought a lot of people, especially nowadays, you know, with everybody armed with phones, making videos of you wherever you are. I mean, you know, imagine it. You know, if you're out in public, you'd just be surrounded by people invading your privacy. They'd be recording it on film as well, and then doing God knows what with it.
Yeah. Yeah, and then if you have the least bit of resistance to it, you become the asshole, and then they put that up on the internet, and then you have to hear about it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Horrible.
Yeah, it's kind of shitty. Mm. Yeah.
No, I doubt if that many people in that position actually enjoy that side of it.
You know. Yeah.
What do you think?
What do I think? Well, I think it's interesting because it feels like hearing you, you know, talk about your work that there's a group of really good musicians who go from session to session and everyone knows everyone. And in the music industry, it feels like good musicians know good musicians and there's a pool of you. And you've come up in a thing where you've got a lot of gigs and being able to be support. Now it feels like everyone has to have a following to get hired for anything.
Yeah. I think it is like that. But our band for sure in Australia, we have a following, and that's the only band apart from, you know, professional recording artists that I've been fortunate enough to work with. That's the only band I've ever had that really has a pretty healthy following. And that's exactly right. That's how it is. Although if we didn't have that, we wouldn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's just,
you've got to justify, you know, you get paid, you've got to justify your fee, haven't you?
Yeah. You have to put butts in seats. Your job is, I was pretty clear that sure. My job is to sell tickets from the very beginning. Mm. It's just what it is.
Yeah. And your audience have got to spend money, not just selling tickets. They've got to come in, and I guess you play in places where they get drinks and they get food as well. You know, they've got to consume.
Yeah. So I think it's you need a healthy following, to keep going. I mean, it has to grow. I mean, it's not like fame for fame's sake, I feel like, is a losing battle. But because I feel like just wanting fame for what? What do you represent? What are you about? What do you want to share with the world? I feel like, since there are a lot of people just blindly wanting fame and doing anything to get that. I feel like that's a shitty way to be.
Yeah, it is. But I guess if we go back to my definition of fame, as in you are well known, if you've got a good product, and lots of people like it and enjoy it, and you become well known because of that. Well, that just goes hand in hand with you being successful and having a good product, being talented, whatever it is, writing great songs, having a great comedy routine, whatever. So that's it goes back to the same thing, fame, being well known because you're good. It's a catch 22, isn't it? You know, you can't really be successful in show business without being well known, can you? Well, can you be anonymous? I suppose, I don't know. Some people might go under some pseudonym.
Well, I think because this seems a lot of session players or background musicians are somewhat anonymous.
Yeah,
I don't know anymore because again, everyone just needs to have a following more and more. But yeah.
Well, those guys. Yeah, maybe. Those guys, and that those days it's a very different world now. I mean, for decades, top musicians would be able to make a really good living just playing studio dates, going in and recording on, playing on recordings, from orchestral recordings to jingles for adverts to hit records. Those days really changed. That was something that totally changed in the latter half of the 1980s, and the sessions just dried up. And those guys who were, super, super pro session musicians are having to make their living selling stuff online and touring nowadays. Whereas before, they could have just said no to all that. I just do studio sessions. That's all I do. And they make a great living doing that. Yeah, that stuff's all over and done with, unfortunately.
Yeah, so different. So I have a question from one of my characters. I was going to do my Queen's Marie, but I feel like you're British. And I'm nervous to do this in front of you. I feel like I should bring Diana out, which is very nerve-wracking for a Brit because you just rail on the American. And I didn't even practice. That's how crazy I am. I'm just bringing her out fresh. I did not like rehearse or anything.
Okay.
Let's see. All right. Well, Alan, I certainly understand the limits of fame because I found it thrilling, but yet quite defeating in some ways. So, Alan, I would like to, I have things that I would like to recommend to young people about. One of my passions is helping young people with their, inspiring them. That was one of my things when I did when I was alive. But so you, what would you, how would you inspire young, what would you say to a young person starting out about how to move forth?
How to move forth? Well, I think get a good teacher. And if you're going to be a musician, do you mean as a musician, Diana?
Well, yes. We'll start a musician and also in show business in general.
I think to learn your craft has got to be the number one priority. So if you're an actor, go to a great acting teacher. If you're a musician, go to a great music teacher. But learn your trade first and foremost. Make sure you're good at what you do. And after that, I'd say try and just be a nice, easygoing person that other people enjoy working with. That's also going to be a big one because you can be the best actor, the best singer, the best musician on the block, but if you're a pain in the ass, excuse my language, Diana, to work with, you're not going to go very far.
Right. I like to also, I don't marry a member of the royal family. That's helpful. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you. All right.
Okay. Pleasure, Your Highness.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, wow.
She has dirty jokes about the... Anyway, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Just tragic. I was just going to say tragic about poor old Diana. It's one of those things you remember, like when John Lennon died or Elvis died or Kennedy died, and people remember where they were and what they were doing, I remember being at the breakfast table with the most atrocious hangover, the hangover from hell at some hotel, and there was a couple next to us. And they were talking, they came down and told us the news. Have you heard the news? No. And then it was the Diana story. And after that, they got telling us about, I always remember this couple, they got telling us about their camping trip. The last holiday they'd had been in New Zealand, and they'd hired a camper van. And a wasp came in through the window and stung the poor guy while he was driving the van. He swerved and he overturned the whole thing, and they ended up in hospital, the pair of them.
Oh, my God.
So that was the news straight after the news that poor Diana had been killed in the car crash.
I'm grown up in Howard Beach, Queens. So we heard it and immediately my dad was like, the Queen did it for sure. Knocked her off. Everyone was like, yeah, please. Are you kidding me? Like, she definitely fucking knocked her daughter-in-law off. 100%.
Well, over here they were saying it was Dodie. It was a Fayyad, sorry. It was Fayyad, but his son wasn't meant to be in it. But he, they wanted the Queen. That's right. The Queen wanted Fayyad dead, the guy she was going to marry, Dodie Fayyad. That's right. No, they did implicate the Queen. There was a big rumor about that over here as well. They didn't want her ending up with a foreigner, an Egyptian.
Yes.
A man of color.
That and there was a lot of, and then actually Fayyad, I've read the book. Actually, so funny, I have the book here. I read the book on it, and apparently, the Fayyad dad, the Fayyad spent a lot of money on this myth about the Queen doing it, and so that was he really wanted to push this forward, and there was actually the writer seemed really fairly looking at each piece of evidence and was like, no, it was just bad driving, poor decision making.
Paparazzi chasing them, yeah, terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, who knows? I mean, there was bound to be a conspiracy theory surrounding it all. She certainly had her enemies in the whole royal family and that establishment.
Right.
That was for sure. But it was just awful, the whole paparazzi thing. She was the the fairy story princess.
Yeah, and then talk about like fame, like the that's like the ultimate like level of fame she had, and like
downside and the downside of it.
Yeah, crazy.
It's funny how what's her name, Kate hasn't got, had to go through that though. I mean, she's an attractive woman as well. I mean, you know, at the beginning, I thought when William married her, I thought she would have gone through it. I guess the world's got just a little bit number to things now, and you know, at that time it was much more special than it is now.
Also
same with Meghan.
Yeah, Diana was a little more. You could tell she was like sad at points, so like she was captive, and she was also more warm, and she would like hug people, and like Kate's more reserved.
Sure. Sure. She put herself out there for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I guess she needed to do something with her life because she wasn't getting much of one with Charles, was she?
I wasn't getting a lot of things with Charles.
Yeah. Have you seen The Crown?
Yes, I have seen The Crown. I haven't watched the Diana stuff though yet.
Right. It was very good, wasn't it? I thought it was really good.
Yeah. So okay, pheromones. You're not really on social. But I did friend you on Facebook. I tried to friend you on Facebook, and Facebook didn't believe we were friends. They were like, only friend people you know. Yeah, I was like, what?
Well, send me a friend request. I don't do Facebook, but if I get a friend request and it's someone I know, I just press the...
Well, they wouldn't. I tried to friend you, and it like said, no, you can't. It's so weird.
Well, shall I try and friend you and see if it works that way around?
Okay.
What have you done?
No, no, I just... My ear things came out. Yeah.
I'll try and send you a friend request.
Okay, perfect. And then where can people? So people could look you up, Alan and Burke, on Facebook. But you're not really into.
Yeah.
Where do you want people to find you?
They can look up the pheromones.
Okay.
They can look up the pheromones. No, I don't really want people to find me, to be honest. No, I don't exist.
Okay, so just go look up the pheromones on Facebook.
With an F.
Okay.
With an F. Pheromones. Or on YouTube, you can find some of us. We need to do some new stuff on YouTube. Sorry, it's all quite old, the stuff on there. But there's some stuff on there that's okay.
Yeah.
There's one called the Pheromones Official Showreel. That's not bad.
I've seen that.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's a little dated.
Yeah.
A little dated. We really must improve. You know, put some new stuff on.
Cool. Well, you're still booking out gigs, so.
Yeah, we're busy from December the 3rd, I think, right the way through till the end of April. We're busy as hell.
Cool.
Well, that's another reason why I'm keeping my hand. Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll be out there again. I hope so too.
Australia, fingers crossed. All right, cool. We'll see you soon, and we'll all check you out. Thanks for coming.
Hope it's been helpful. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. You can follow the podcast on my page at Lauren Logi. Updates and inside info on my email list, LaurenLogi.com. Thank you to Annie McCutcheon for editing, Edward Silla at Radio Misfits Podcast Network, and Maddie McLennan for making the podcast art. Thanks to our listeners for bringing us back for another season. We'll see you soon.
The proceeding was a presentation of the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. Find our other great shows on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at RadioMisfits.com. Thank you.